Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous. So justice goes forth perverted. Have you ever questioned what God was up to? Have you ever been angry at what you've seen around you and wondered why God was seemingly indifferent to it? Have you ever cried out, God, do you see? God, do you hear? God, do you care? If those have ever been your cries, or perhaps their cries right now, then you're going to love the book of Habakkuk, because those cries are Habakkuk's cries as well. However, before we can bring Habakkuk to 2012 and plant him right here and unpack him in the context that we live in, we first need to go back to Habakkuk and get a little background of its setting, historicity, chronology, and the like. So let me give you some background. First, what in heaven's name is a Habakkuk? Right? That's a pretty good, what's a Habakkuk? Well, Habakkuk is many things, but primarily what Habakkuk is, it's a book that uses a man's perplexities. Okay, a man's perplexities to declare God's instructions to his people who are distressed. Distressed because of the wickedness that they are living in the midst of. That's a good overview statement, I think. It's God using a man's perplexities, relaying through him to a people that are disillusioned, even worse, in angst because of the world they live in. And therefore, Habakkuk is a book, although written 2,700 or so years ago, has much relevance and practicality to where we live today. The book of Habakkuk, just to give you a little bit more backing and background of it, it's part of a larger grouping of 12 books in the Old Testament that are referred to as the minor prophets. Not minor because they're not as important as the major prophets, but minor because of their length. The message that we are going to find in Habakkuk, this short little three-chaptered book, is as key for us, important for us, as any of the messages that we would find in some of the major prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, and so forth. So that is what Habakkuk is. But who is Habakkuk? In other words, who is Habakkuk the man? Well, the difficulty in answering that question is, comes because what we know of Habakkuk is found in what we read about him in the book of Habakkuk. In other words, what we read about Habakkuk is the entirety of what we know from the scriptures. There's no other mention of him anywhere else. However, and importantly, Habakkuk is one of the few who have had the opportunity to dialogue with God and even complain about God's apparent indifference. We're going to see not just him casting questions and complaints towards God. We will see Habakkuk in dialogue with him. Habakkuk, in some ways, is very similar to Psalms of Lament, where writers cry out, as they do in places like Psalm 10, verse 1, why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Or, like we read in Psalm 13, verses 1 and 2, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? So that is what Habakkuk is. That is who, at least a small snippet. And thirdly, when is Habakkuk? Well, most date the book in the early 7th century BC. If you've ever read the book of Daniel, in the book of Daniel, what you have recorded there is the captivity of God's people by the by the Babylonians. And what we more than likely, most likely have in the book of Habakkuk is the lead up to that event, those events in the book of Daniel. In the near lead up to those events of Daniel, that's where we find ourselves with Habakkuk. The Chaldeans, and you can see them mentioned in verse 6 of chapter 1. We're going to spend a lot of time looking at the Chaldeans next week. They were originally a group of loosely organized tribes that occupied a large portion of what was then, before the Babylonian Empire, the Assyrian Empire. But they were pains in the size of the Assyrian leadership. And eventually, the Chaldeans successfully rebelled against the Assyrian powers, ruling all of Babylonia as a result, and therefore establishing the Babylonian Empire. What were they like? Their reputation was horrific. The Chaldeans slash Babylonians were warlike. They were cruel. Habakkuk actually describes them, and you can see this in verses 6 and 8, bitter and hasty. They seized dwellings not their own. They raped, they pillaged, they maimed, they murdered. And in verse 8, their horsemen came from afar, meaning that they would travel far and wide to ransack anybody who was available to be ransacked. That's the Chaldeans slash Babylonians. That's who they are. It's important for us to get that because they play a major part in the story of Habakkuk. However, I almost went to the other one. Did you hear me there? I almost went to Habakkuk. I'm going to go back and forth. I know it. However, and this is an important point. If that was the state of the Chaldeans slash Babylonians at the time, warlike, cruel, rape, pillage, and the like, ruled the world, what was the state of the people of God? Specifically, the kingdom of Judah. At this time, Israel was in two different kingdoms, a northern and a southern kingdom. And the southern kingdom of Judah, what was the state of it as we walk into Habakkuk? Well, it couldn't have been worse. The lead up of its leadership of the nation, of the kingdom of Judah, to this point was horrific. They did not follow the ways and the decrees of God. They did evil in the sight of God. And most of the people, except for always a small remnant of righteous ones, would follow suit. It was one king after the other, after the other. Every once in a while, there would be a respite. One king would rise up, but his son or somebody else would step in and go back to the other way. And leading up to this time, it was as bad as it got for the kingdom of Judah. In fact, in 2 Chronicles 36, verses 5 and 6, we read this. And this pulls the kingdom of Babylon, the Chaldeans, and Judah all together. It says this in verses 5 and 6. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God, just like his daddy did, by the way. Against him came up Nebuchadnezzar, probably the most well-known king of Babylon, and bound him in chains to take him to Babylon. And that ushers in the Daniel story. And what I'm arguing for is this is Habakkuk right before that takes place, in the years leading up to it. This is their state, doing evil in the sight of the Lord. Here's the rising of the Chaldeans that we're going to look at. That's some history and chronology giving us some backing for the book. Important for us to know if we're going to appreciate God's sovereign involvement in all of it, which is going to stretch us, and we'll get into that in a little bit too. So that's enough intro. If I've missed anything, glossed over anything, we'll hit it in greater detail in the weeks ahead. So let's get into the book. Let's just read verse 1. Verse 1, we read the oracle that Habakkuk, the prophet, saw. Just stop there. We discover three things in this verse, believe it or not, that are important for us. One is the book of Habakkuk is an oracle. The word oracle literally means burden. Some of you may use a King James Version translation of the Bible, and it actually translates that word with burden in the King James Version. It's an appropriate word for the message that comes out of these three chapters is burdensome. It's a book that has packed in it great words of blessing and encouragement. But it's burdensome for it also has words of judgment too. It's burdensome because it has words in it that stretch our understanding of God. And oftentimes when our understanding of God is stretched, it's stretched to places that we would rather not venture. And so things we hear about God, discover about God and his nature and his work and his involvement stretches, and it becomes burdensome to us when we hear it, or it becomes burdensome because we got to speak into somebody else's life about their perception of who God is. And that's burdensome to be a declarer as well. It's burdensome, for this is not a book that promises that every day will be a Friday. This is not a book that gives a happy clappy, easy listening, soft rock, 104.9 answer to the perplexities of life. Instead, it's a book that recognizes that life brings days and seasons where all we want to do is cry out. And it gives us permission to. It's also a book that assures that those whose hope in God perseveres through the adversity around him, and they will be saved. So it's an oracle. It's a burden. It has that sort of vibe and feel and pressure within it. And there's encouragement in it as well. But it's that type of book. The second thing that we see in verse 1 is that Habakkuk was a prophet. We don't know much about Habakkuk, right? We don't. We get what we get from this book, but we discover right from the very beginning was that he was a prophet. One author writes this, that in light of not knowing much about him, knowing little about Habakkuk, his significance then comes not in who he is, but in what he says. This shouldn't surprise us, because a lack of credentials was commonplace for the prophets. Their resumes were slim, their words were weighty, in other words. A prophet's qualifications, to put it a different way, were in his call. As one put it, the message was greater than the man, and it needs to be. The last Old Testament prophet was John the Baptist. Even though we read about him in the New, he was the last Old Testament prophet. And one day he was asked by the priests and the Levites, "Who are you?" He confessed, "I am not the Christ." And they asked him, "What then? Are you Elijah?" He said, "I am not." "Are you the prophet?" And he answered, "No." So they said to him, "Who are you? We need to give an answer to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself? What's your backing? What's your credentials? What's your resume? What's your education? What gives you the right to do this?" He answered, "I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, 'Make straight the way of the Lord.'" The next day, John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. This is he of whom I said, 'After me comes a man who ranks before me because he was before me.'" John's life mission as a good and faithful prophet is wrapped up in John 3, verse 30, where he says this, speaking of Jesus, "He must increase, but I must decrease." And I don't want you to miss the connection between oracle, the burden, and prophet, because there is a burden that comes with faithful prophetic ministry. If every message you and I give, whether we're speaking to thousands or an individual, if every message that we give is easy to give, we're probably not being faithful to the call that we've been given. The third thing to see in verse 1 is that Habakkuk writes what he saw. See that word "saw" there? This is further understood in verse 2 of chapter 2, where God instructs, and just if you wouldn't mind putting your eyes down to chapter 2, verse 2, where God instructs Habakkuk to write the vision, make it plain on tablets. In fact, the word "saw," as it's used in verse 1 of chapter 1, refers more to vision than simple observance. And this helps us understand how Habakkuk has this dialogue with God. Because I think when we put it all together, what we have is Habakkuk directing his complaints towards God. God replies in a vision, and Habakkuk writes it down. I think that's how we have this book coming together. That's verse 1. Those are three important aspects, and it sets the stage for what comes next. And what comes next in verses 3, 2, 3, and 4 is the first of two complaints. Two complaints from Habakkuk. We're going to look at the first one today. We're going to look at the response next week from God to the complaint, and then we're going to look at a second complaint in a couple of weeks. What we see in the first complaint is that Habakkuk asks two questions. The first is seen in verse 2, and it's the question, how long? You see it there. How long? This is the complaint of unanswered prayer. But it's actually even more than that. For Habakkuk's complaint wasn't only that God seemingly wasn't listening, but that he seemed not to care. I mean, look at verse 2 again. How long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence, and you will not save? You're not listening, and you're not caring. Have you ever felt like you cared more than God does? Have you ever felt that you could be, would be more responsive to things than God is? Have you ever felt that you could do a better job being God than God himself? One thing confronting us in this book is that God allows us for a purpose to live in places where we conclude that he's not listening and does not care. Let me say that again. What we will be confronted with in this book is that God allows us to live in times and places for a purpose where we conclude he is not listening and does not care. He allows it. Verse 2 type cries are common today, by the way. Verse 2 type cries today are cries like, how can I believe in a supposedly good and powerful God and reconcile that with what I see around me? And what Habakkuk saw is recorded for us in verse 3. Take a look at verse 3. What we have there are three couplets of things that Habakkuk is looking at. Iniquity and wrong. Iniquity and wrong all around him. Destruction and violence. And the third couplet, strife and contention. He is seeing all of these things. In historical context, if you know anything about the people of God at this time, there was chaos. There was some economic collapse. There was food shortage. There was rampant violence. And there was a disregard for God's laws, God's decrees. Does that sound at all familiar? Do you see the relevance of this to our time today? And to make matters worse, look at verse 4. It tells us that justice wasn't being served. Verse 4, I'll read it one more time. The law is paralyzed. Justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. I mean, in other words, what we get here from Habakkuk's perception is, look, this is going on. Iniquity, injustice, strife, destruction, violence, contention, and justice isn't being served. The wicked are winning. And few things fire us up more or cause us to cry out more fervently to God or otherwise when we see justice not being served. Have you ever wondered why? Have you ever wondered why it is that we burn internally so heatedly when we see the wicked get off scot-free? I mean, we all want justice. I know some would say, no, the unjust don't want justice, but yes, in fact, they do. When something unjust is inflicted even on the most wicked, they too cry unfair. See, people love to get away with things. I'm not arguing against that. People love to get away with things, but no one likes to be the recipient of unfairness. So I ask again, have you ever considered why? The answer the Bible gives is that our intolerance toward injustice or our passion for it, to be people who bring justice, is an internal indicator evidencing the existence of God. To put it another way, our scream at things when they are unjust or our commitment to bring justice in is a demonstration of our imago Dei, that we have been created in the image of one who is altogether just. Why do I say that? Why do I say the Bible speaks to that? Well, in Romans chapter 2, verse 15, Paul writes there of those who know nothing or little of God, his ways, his decrees, his law, but yet, in spite of that, they show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. In other words, they don't know much about God, if anything at all. They've never read the law. They don't know his decrees, his ways, but they live right. And if they don't, they're convicted because of not doing so. And what Paul argues for in Romans chapter 2 is this is a demonstration that there is something bigger going on. This is a demonstration of the internal working of God, that they have been created in his image. N.T. Wright, in his book Simply Christian, calls our quest for justice, along with our quest for spirituality and transcendence and relationships and love and our attraction to all things beautiful, echoes of who God is and what he calls us to, what he wants from us. You ever wonder why a two-year-old looks at somebody and goes, "Mommy, Daddy, that's beautiful"? Do you ever wonder why you crave relationship like you do? Yearn for, I mean, in our world today, in light of people's rejection of Creator, why at the same time is spirituality ramped up to the levels that it is? Why do we quest and search and walk and yearn after those things? Again, what authors and the scriptures point to is it evidences the handiwork of God in our lives. So Habakkuk cried out against what seemed like continual injustice. How long? It's going on forever, man. But not only was it continual, it was internal. This isn't Habakkuk complaining about the world out there. This is Habakkuk complaining about what was going on within God's people. They, as the orchestrators of it. As one commentator put it regarding the state of Judah at this time, there is dry rot in the land. The wicked do what they want. Justice never goes forth. Wicked surround the few righteous. Justice is perverted. God, therefore, Habakkuk screams out, "How long will you tolerate this?" Before I begin wrapping up, and it'll be a slow wrap up, so don't get comfortable. I want us to note two important aspects of Habakkuk's cry. Okay, just note these. Two important aspects of his cry. The first is obvious, but it's key. Habakkuk cries out to God. I mean, just if you like underlying things, highlighting things, just note again what it says in verse 2 and the first part of verse 3. "O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong?" See, there is a difference between crying about God and crying to God. I want us to notice that he cries to God, which I think begs an obvious question. Who do you cry to? For some of us, that will cause us to have to dig pretty deep. Where do you cry? Do you ever turn your cries to God? Or is it simply a buddy, a bottle, more shopping, more food, recreation? Where do you cry? Where do your cries manifest themselves? Habakkuk cried to God. I know some of us feel uncomfortable with cries like this directed at God. Some of us get really uncomfortable at crying at God, complaining to God. Others of us declare never having to cry out to God like this. I don't ever direct my cries to God like this. However, truth be told, many never do so because, not because of a trust they have in God, but simply because they have an indifference to the world. Not only don't I think it's wrong to cry out to God like this in light of the things that we see around us, I would encourage us that it needs to be a demonstration in our lives. It needs to be an aspect of our lives. For us to live our lives in light of what we see around us and go, nope, not a part of my life. I know God's in charge. So did Habakkuk. We need to have days where we walk around our city and like Paul, after he ventured around the city of Athens, come back and go, man, there's a lot here that troubles me. See, perhaps we don't cry like this to God because we just don't have a burden for people. We need to be freed up. We need to gain some permission to take these types of cries to God. You see, West Side, the question isn't whether or not God welcomes our cries and complaints. The question is whether we're willing to listen when he answers. But what I've been challenged with about God's activity in response to our prayers is that he isn't so unkind as to answer our prayers in our time frame. For perhaps between our cries and his response, there's work to be done in us or others. Perhaps certain things need to be stripped away in us or others. Idols revealed in us or others. Selfishness spotlighted in us or others. Faithlessness illuminated in us or others. See, an earlier intervention by God may have relieved Habakkuk's angst, but it would not have served the nation, the kingdom of Judah, well. This should change how we pray, by the way. Because we can get really happy-clappy with our theology around prayer. God always answers yes, no, or wait. No, he doesn't. That assumes we always pray correctly, for one, when we don't. Directionally pray, right? There are a lot more grander reasons why God responds, how he responds to our prayers. That should cause us to dig a little bit deeper in what he wants to do with us and others before he intervenes in ways that he hope he does, that we hope he does. A second and final thing to note about Habakkuk's cry to God, if that was the first, he directed his cry to God. Here's a second and final. It was birthed out of an understanding of who God is and what God had promised. See, Habakkuk's cry erupted out of this jealousy. I know the word jealousy is a weird word. Jealousy simply means this passion, this commitment, this possessiveness for God's holiness and an understanding of his promises. Habakkuk knew God. He knew the character of God. He knew what God was all about. He knew what God had promised. He knew the call that his people had from him. In a very real sense, what this is for Habakkuk is a crisis of faith. This is where we are introduced to him in the midst of a crisis of faith. God, I believe you are righteous. God, I believe you are holy. And God, you have called your people. And you've promised blessing when they follow. And discipline when they don't. But right now, there's nothing. In fact, it's absolutely upside down. The wicked are prospering. They're not following you. And they're prospering. In fact, they're overwhelming the righteous, and the righteous are getting absolutely ramrodded by this group, and it makes no sense. You seem quiet and indifferent. This is a crisis of faith. And here's my guess. Some of you are living in a crisis of faith right now. In fact, I know some of you are. God's response to Habakkuk's cry comes next week. This is a 7-week series, but it's really one message with 7 parts. But let me give you this much today. God's response, as we will see next week, demonstrates that he answers in ways that we may not always expect. In fact, sometimes God's answers take us even deeper into our crisis before lifting us back out again. We'll see that next week. As we close, I do want you to notice one last thing coming out of verse 4. Look at verse 4. I take you here again, for in it we are reminded of God's ultimate answer and response to injustice and wickedness and our cries in the midst of them. Take a look at verse 4. I'll read it one more time. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. With that ringing in your ears, fast forward about 700 years. And let me ask you, does this remind you of another time when the wicked surrounded the righteous and God seemed altogether silent there too? Jesus, the perfect, spotless, righteous Lamb of God, surrounded by scoffers and mockers, forsaken by his Father, crying out much like Habakkuk cried out. Why? Why? To serve as the ultimate answer to Habakkuk's and our cries, our deepest cries. The ultimate answer to our deepest cries. God, do you hear me? His ultimate answer? Jesus. God, do you see the pain I'm in? His ultimate answer? Jesus. God, do you care about my pain? His ultimate answer? Jesus. God, do you see my trouble? His ultimate answer, Jesus. God, what's your plan for the world? God, what's your plan for me? His ultimate answer, Jesus. See, Westside, the good news is that God will one day rid the cosmos of all that is wicked. Our groanings will cease. But what he also tells us is that the wickedness and the injustice isn't just out there. It's in here too. That wickedness isn't just out there, it's here. That injustice isn't just out there, it's here. And his answer to what ails us in here, the life, death, resurrection of Jesus, his righteous Son, killed at the hands of wicked men in our place for our sin, as God's watched silently. Are you listening? Would you rise as we respond, please?